Well, good evening, everybody. I'm thrilled to see a full house here tonight. My name's Andrew Willis. I am a director at the Canadian Journalism Foundation. And I thank you for joining us to the latest installment of J-Talks, which is a discussion between Bloomberg News founder and editor emeritus Matt Winkler and in conversation with Jackie McNish. This event is part of our J-Talks series, and it's made possible through the support of Bank of Montreal, along with Canada Newswire and CPAC, who will be televising tonight's events. So thank you very much for their support. And we encourage you to be an active audience tonight. As part of this evening's event, you're invited to tweet your questions or your comments to hashtag CFJJTalk, and we look forward to your input. I'm now proud to introduce you to our monitor tonight, my former colleague and a journalist I'm sure most of you make a point of reading. Jack McNish is the Toronto-based senior correspondent with the Wall Street Journal. She's been a business journalist for more than three decades at the Wall Street Journal and at the Globe and Mail, working from Toronto and from New York. She is the winner of nine and counting national newspaper awards and three national book awards. She's also an adjunct professor in her spare time at the Osgoode Hall Law School, where she co-teaches a course on shareholder protection for law students and for journalists. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jackie for a fabulous discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Andy.
I apologize for all those crumpled pieces of paper I threw at your head on deadline in the hurly-burly of getting the stories out. It's my great pleasure to be here tonight. Matt Winkler, founding editor-in-chief and currently editor emeritus of Bloomberg News. I cannot think of another editor-in-chief who has reigned for a quarter of a century. That is an anomaly in these days of constant change. So you are going to have the benefit tonight of more than 60 years of journalistic experience between the two of us. And it is a fantastic story and an improbable story, the Bloomberg story. In 1990, Matt left the comfort of the Wall Street Journal to help launch Bloomberg News with a former Salomon Brothers equity salesman named Michael Bloomberg, who many of you know as the former mayor of New York. And during your tenure at Bloomberg News, the agency received more than 800 awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting. He's a born and raised New Yorker with a history degree from Kenyon College, and early reporting gigs that included Ohio's Mount Vernon News, a hotbed of business journalism, New York Bonds Buyer, Barron's, and the Wall Street Journal. Today we know Bloomberg as a global organization, a communications and technology giant with thousands of subscribers, thousands of employees, I should say hundreds of thousands of subscribers, thousands, as we do that at the Wall Street Journal, we underestimate your importance, thousands of employees, and they produce more than 5,000 published stories daily. Also has a vast stable of television, radio, and other media. When Michael Bloomberg founded the company in 1981, few took this company seriously. When Matt helped him launch Bloomberg News in 1990, I have it on good authority, a number of his former Wall Street Journal colleagues generously gave him the names of their psychiatrists. It was a crazy thing to do. Matt's going to give us the inside story tonight on an improbable rise and rise of Bloomberg. And I'm very glad in particular to see so many young journalists here tonight. It is a tough time in newsrooms, and tonight you're going to get a great case study on how new technology and news platforms can open a new wave of journalism jobs that few would have anticipated in 1981. So please join me in welcoming Matt. So I did my research. If I get anything wrong, you can be the Donald Trump. You just butt in and say you're wrong. Shut up. Or whatever you may want to add to what I may or may not have correct. Bloomberg, as I understand it, was founded in 1981, and the first terminal was produced and placed a year later, 1982, give or take a little time. Now, 1982, think about that. That's 1 year after the first IBM PC has been produced, years before the first internet browser, Netscape, was created. There was no Google. Journalists didn't use the internet. There was no Twitter or any of the social media tools we take for granted. And so my first question for you is, how did Mike Bloomberg go from being an equity salesman to a technology and content entrepreneur?
He did it with a physics degree. And before I go any further, I just want to say how delighted I am to be here. Some people in this room are my old friends, so it's great to be back. And also, it's not a secret, this is probably my favorite country. Increasingly so, by the way, for reasons that...
After November 8th, well, you're welcome here.
No, all kidding aside, he was a scientist by avocation. And it's really important to put him in that context before he even got to Salomon Brothers. He, in fact, in his philanthropy, just made a huge donation to the Boston Museum of Science, where growing up, every weekend he would take the T-line there in Boston. And as an engineer, he was like a lot of engineers, you know, always thinking about what to do with things. And he went to Johns Hopkins, and that's where he did his undergraduate work, and then he went to Harvard Business School. And when he came out, he was at Salomon Brothers, probably one of the more educated people to land at the firm, which didn't actually stand him in good stead back then, because too many of the firm's partners were not as well educated as he was. And you know, he never touched a bond. This was a firm that was a bond trading house, and he was on the other side. Those people who have read Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis can appreciate that, because his mentor actually was sort of equities in Dallas. And while he was at Salomon Brothers, he had this idea, because he would look around the trading floor and he would see all these Wall Street journals piled high densely by desks. And he'd say, wouldn't it be great if all the information that was in the newspapers and all the information that the firm's traders and salespeople had was put in one place on a computer. This was the days of Fortran, by the way. I know I'm dating myself. That was the language. And his colleagues at the firm thought that was a ridiculous idea. But they said, you know what? If you're really committed to this, you can do it in your own time. So he bribed some people with pizza and beer in the back office, and he put together what became known as the B page. And when you think about that, that system, it was a primitive computer at Salomon Brothers. The firm didn't appreciate what it had, and the proof of that is Salomon would be acquired, actually it was like a reverse takeover, by Phillip Brothers in Chicago, a commodity trading firm. And the new firm, Vibro Salomon, had no use for Mike Bloomberg.
So the B page was like a daily summary of core news and data?
It wasn't so much news, it was the firm's positions. So everybody knew where the firm was positioned on a, you know, any number of fronts. I don't think it had much news on it back in the day. It was really data. But that's the key thing, it was data. And that was the, if you like, the prototype of what would become known as the Bloomberg system. But it started literally in that decade, the 70s, which was a horrendous decade, by the way. You know, Business Week, which we would later acquire in 1979, famously had a cover, The Death of Equities. Of course, that was the beginning of the bull market in stocks. Literally, they couldn't have timed it better.
So he took a package. He cashed in his whatever.
It was more
equity
than a package.
He had
become a partner, because he had somehow done, he's a precocious fellow, as you doubtless observed, and he had done as well even in equities to the extent that he was made a partner, but he didn't go very far within the firm. And so by the time it was, you know, he was there 16 years. By the time the merger had occurred and gone through, he was told, you're done. But he was allowed to take his partnership stake, which was about $10 million at the time, which was an enormous amount of money in 1979, 1980. And You're right, 81. Literally the day after he left the firm, he got himself a little office on Madison Avenue. And he convinced a couple people who had worked with him in Solomon to join him, and the firm was born.
And so the initial idea was to sell what information to people?
This is the greatest question. He thought, because the bond market at that point was telling every other market in the world. Now remember, this is 1981. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is in the worst recession since the Great Depression. Ronald Reagan has just been elected. The deregulation that sort of started kind of in Chicago in the futures and options markets in the late 70s was sweeping across the US with this Reagan, you know, revolution. It would soon, by the way, captivate London. Maggie Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, was the prime minister, and she was about to do something very similar. And treasury bonds, US treasury bonds, were the instrument of choice in the global, emerging global financial market. And what Bloomberg, in its infancy, did was enable the people who traded treasury bonds to know the relative value of any treasury bond going back decades. And the data was based on actually accessible data. It was government data. You know, treasury bonds come from the US Treasury. So it was very smart on his part. He didn't have to go very far to get the data. He got everybody's prices, leased from the US Treasury, or the Federal Reserve, which is the agent of the Treasury, going back decades, put it on a computer. The reason why it was so important and unique is up until that time, the sell side, as we call it, the brokerages, the banks, they told everybody else what they should be buying and selling. That's the liar's poker.
Right. There wasn't that much transparency.
There was no transparency. Yeah. And if you were the State of California retirement system, or you were the Bank of England, or you were the Federal Reserve, you were beholden, believe it or not, to Salomon Brothers and all kinds of other firms that told you every day you ought to buy the 12s of 2010 and you ought to sell the 12 and 3 quarters of 2011. Those would be like two treasury coupons.
Right.
Bloomberg, the scientist, says, what if I get all of the prices that are available, because it's government data, I put them on a computer, so that when the salesperson calls the Bank of England and says you ought to buy these securities and sell those, the Bank of England can say, well, that was a good trade last week, but it's not a good trade today. And by the way, don't call me again.
So you got this power shift away from the mystique of the Wall Street broker dealers.
Hugely disruptive.
Towards the buy side.
Hugely disruptive. Right. Built around data, but very important data. You could argue that this data was the data that would determine everybody's market, at least for a while.
And what's so fascinating looking back on this is, so he's not content to basically shake up Wall Street. He wants to get into the business of the news, and he phones you at about 1989, and he says, what is it going to take for me to get the news business? And you present him with an ethical dilemma. Why don't you tell the audience what that dilemma was?
Well, I had observed, as you can tell, Bloomberg as a reporter. I had observed the man and the company as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And I was actually, to say the least, impressed, but more frightened of what Bloomberg in its infancy was. Because at the time, even though he was insignificant, people didn't know what he did or what his company was about. What he was involved with was very disruptive. And as a reporter, I could see that his data was maybe 3-4 weeks ahead of anything I would possibly write, which was very demoralizing to me.
Because you would call up people and they would tell you, and there it was on a screen.
That they saw, you know, I thought I had a good idea of where markets were headed. And you know, we all want to write where are tomorrow's prices, right? But his system in its infancy with the data. So, yeah. So he, meanwhile, is developing his product. He is winning customers on the buy side, institutional investors, like the Bank of England, like the Bank of Canada, like the Federal Reserve, like Fidelity. He is loathed by his former colleagues at Salomon Brothers and the entire securities industry. I mean, loathed, because he's considered to be actually an enemy. He realizes, though, that in order for his system to succeed, he probably needs news for two reasons. The first reason is he'd want to have news anyway, and if he bought somebody else's news, he would be punished for his success. Meaning, if he sells another terminal, the rent from AP or Dow Jones would go up, right? He didn't want to pay a penalty for his own success. So that was one reason. The other reason was, if he had the news would lead his customers to the best of his data. Because from one day to the next, the news is obviously different. And so if he has news, his own news, it is going to drive interest in his data at the same time. So that was the formula. So he called me. We knew each other because I was writing about Bloomberg as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, not primarily as the focus of my beat, but he was in the securities industry. And the focus for me was, here is somebody who is potentially a huge disruptor. So he says, what does it take to get in the news business? And knowing him as I did, I didn't have the foggiest idea, you know, what the dollar sign and the number next to it would be. I mean, just clueless about that. But what I did ask him was, all right, just imagine you're in the news business and your reporter is writing about your biggest customer, which at that time was Merrill Lynch, because that was his conduit, really, vehicle.
They had a 30% stake initially in the company.
They did have a 30% stake at that time. And I said, okay, so your reporter writes a story about Merrill, your biggest customer. Story says the president has absconded with a lot of money. He's water skiing with secretary and Rio. It's all true. You know, you get a call from the chairman of Merrill, says, Mike, that story that's on the Bloomberg today, we don't like that story. And you know we have 2,000 Bloomberg terminals on our trading floor. And if you don't remove that story, we'll remove the, you know, we'll remove the terminals. And so I said to Mike, so what do you do? And he looked at me, and you've seen this expression on him many times now because he gets it often. He didn't bat an eye. He just smiled at me, and then he said, my lawyers will love you.
All the fees.
And they did, by the way. The truth is, his lawyers were really busy.
But he's a businessman. He's from the trading milieu. He didn't care. He just, is he enough of a sort of a rebel or a contrarian that he was
to understand Michael Bloomberg, you know, people today know him as a philanthropist. He was always a philanthropist, actually. And the philanthropy, which is essentially giving back for him, all about giving back, is, you know, is really how much he loves being an American, loves his country. I mean, it's pretty corny stuff, but he really believes it. And he's always believed it. And part of that is, you know, he believes in democracy. He believes in actually a free press, even though they tortured him while he was mayor. And there were some days where I think he might want to take that back. But, you know, the truth is that he really did get it, fundamentally get it, which impressed me. I could see that he got it. And he got, you know, what what really makes the U.S. at its best. It's not going through its best right now, but he got it. And so he never lost it either, by the way.
So when you decided that you were going to go there, what was the motivation for you? Because you were working at one of the best business news organizations in the world at the Wall Street Journal.
Jackie, I think I was the happiest reporter working at the Wall Street Journal at the time. In 1990, I loved everything I was doing. I was covering the securities industry, which was going through all kinds of train wrecks. So it was a good story every single day, the characters, the personalities. I had developed, you know, sources everywhere, so I felt like I had a lot of freedom. And I couldn't imagine myself anywhere else, actually, doing anything else. I was 35 years old, two kids, you know, life was great. And so when he said, I'm going to do this, you're going to do it for me, when can you start, just like that. You know, I initially said to him, you got to be kidding me. I said, why would I do that? Look at where I am. You know, I know what you're doing is significant, but nobody's heard of you, which was true. And he said, well, you know, if you fail, you can always go back and do what you were doing. You said it just like that. And I said, okay, well, look, I'll think about it, and I'll let you know tomorrow. And all that afternoon, I started thinking about it. And initially, my inclination was I'd be crazy to leave the Wall Street Journal where I was at the time. But then I started asking myself, okay, am I going to ask what would it have been like had I done this? And that scared me a lot because I was so comfortable where I was. And the more I thought about it, the more scared I got. And to the point where I thought he was right, that, okay, if I fail, it's not like I'm going to lose the skills that I've acquired and, you know, something will turn up or whatever. So there was something about what was going on in the world at the time. The U.S. was actually in a slowdown recession, 1990. It was not a good period, by the way, for news organizations. Even then, it was a difficult period. And the bigger story was that what he was doing was increasingly driving the financial industry, that financial information, this is 4 years before Netscape, mm-hmm. you know, kind of introduced the internet to everybody. And what he had already was something that was real time, 24/7, global in scope. And the idea that you could marry data with narrative was tantalizing to me, because having come from the Wall Street Journal, which had, of course, the Wall Street Journal, so at the time, you know, one of the greatest newspapers in the world. It had its own news service, Dow Jones. But in journalism, there was a real dichotomy between this just in, which was the news service, mm-hmm. the ticker, mm-hmm. as we called it, and the once a day, once a week, once a month news that was otherwise known as a newspaper or magazine. And they didn't...
No, the Newswire was the second-class citizen. They were
the
poor cousin.
They didn't come together. And so what I started thinking about, actually, that afternoon was, well, what if you could do the best of the Wall Street Journal real time, and you could do everything else? What if you could combine it? And if you had all this data to supplement what you were reporting, wouldn't you have a product that might be considered unique, if not difficult, to replicate? And that was what I was thinking about. He obviously had thought about this too. I don't think quite the way I did as a journalist, but he thought about it. And so the next day, I surprised myself and I called him and I said, okay, we're gonna do this. Now, it took me a long time to get out of the journal because we didn't wanna upset any cards or anything. So I think it was like a 5 months notice or something.
But, yeah. He once said that you submitted the worst expense estimate and the history of expense estimates by predicting that you would need three staff to do the job.
Yeah, well,
tell us about
he actually said, so what is it? So then the next conversation after we decided, so now what does it take to you know? And I said, well, to start, you need five reporters in New York, and you need five reporters in London, you need five reporters in Tokyo. For some reason, I left Washington out of the equation. Typical New Yorker. And he remembers me saying three in each. Okay,
right. Oh, so three in each. Okay.
You know, so you know, I said five. I said 15 to begin with, and he immediately said, "No, that's three." You said, and I said, "No, I said five." So we hired 15 that first year.
And your approach was very deliberate, and you've hinted at what you just said about taking the best of the Wall Street Journal. And I remember then my friends were going to work for this place called Bloomberg, and they kept talking about the Bloomberg spread, which was what happened to their waistlines after they helped themselves to the free lunches that you made available to all the journalists. But you also had the Bloomberg way. I mean, it's really like a cult that you kind of started here. Tell us about the Bloomberg way and what your vision of what the news had to be to succeed.
Well, you know, to put it in perspective, I was not being facetious, we were complete unknowns. And even with whatever I brought to the enterprise, it was by no means sufficient to establish ourselves as a credible news organization, because we had no lineage, no pedigree. As you said, Mike Bloomberg was, in fact, most people today still think of him as a bond trader, even though, as we discussed, he never got that far. But he was somebody from Wall Street, so he was viewed with suspicion. The journalists initially, you know, thought he wasn't fit to lead anything close to journalism. So this was a real challenge. And I recognized, having come from the Wall Street Journal, that you know, elements of style matter, of course. And the more rigorous the elements of style, the greater authority, credibility, the reporting. And I also thought it would be necessary for people at Bloomberg to understand, well, why are we here? What are we doing? And the only way to do that was to put it literally into words. This is what we do. This is why we do it. Fortunately, I felt I had come from as good a platform in journalism as any, and so I had a grounding and an understanding and a knowledge for which I'm, you know, forever grateful. And I tried to bring that sensibility that we were both colleagues at the time at the Wall Street Journal, but critically add to it, the element of the power of data and using data, and that the combination of the two would be something that people hadn't seen before in a news organization or a news service. And the only way to do that was to literally create or write a book called The Bloomberg Way. It's his news organization. It wasn't my news mm-hmm. organization, it was his. That's why we call it The Bloomberg Way. And to try to address every aspect of journalism in the course of covering government, companies, the economy, markets, and every other subject for that matter, and as we evolved.
You had the five F's. Why don't you tell the audience?
Yeah, well, look, it's 1990, and as I said, there was in journalism everywhere, not just in North America, but in Europe and Asia, there was a divide between this just in and the narrative,
right.
What some people call longer form or long form journalism. And they never got together, or they hadn't gotten together at that point. And so what I said was, okay, what is it that is going to create an opportunity for us journalistically and as a business if we can do five things really well? And these are the five things that everybody in journalism wants to do, regardless of where they're coming from, whether it's Dow Jones or Reuters or the Wall Street Journal and Time Magazine. And that is, you want to be the first word, because if you're not the first word, you don't have the surprises. And if you don't have the surprises, you're not doing news. So you want to be the first word. You want to be the fastest word, because same reason. The news is changing all the time. You want to be the most factual word, because if it isn't true, it isn't news. You want to be the final word, so that people, when they finish reading you, have a sense of, I understand why I need to know this and what it does for me. And you want to be the future word, because you want to have some idea, when you get done reading us, what is this going to mean tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and so on. So that was the five Fs. It was five words. And that was an organizing base of knowledge for how to apply everything we did at Bloomberg. And everybody could understand it. There was more to it than that. You know, when I was at the Wall Street Journal, there was a great pride in being able to explain anything that was complicated in words or prose that anyone could understand. So we invented somebody in the Bloomberg way called Ann Agatha and said, you're writing for Ann Agatha. Every story you write is in. And you know, I'd get pushback immediately for, wait a minute, I'm writing for a trader. Why do I need to write for Ann Agatha? And I said, well, you know, who do you think that trader is that you're writing for? I said, you know, that trader is probably reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez on the beach, okay? And so if you can write your way around any subject, you're going to command his attention. And you're going to command his respect. And if you write for somebody who knows nothing, you're also going to command a lot of attention. You're going to have a bigger audience. So we started telling people, you're writing for Ann Agatha. You're writing for dopes and pros. You're writing so that the dope can understand it and the professional can appreciate it, those two things.
So you start with 15 in about 1990. By 2000, how many do you have? How quickly had you scaled up?
Hundreds. By 2000, we were many hundreds.
So the ethical dilemmas that you had prophesized did come true.
Oh, almost immediately.
And tell the audience a little bit about some of the challenges you faced.
Yeah, well.
Poking your finger into the eyes
of
Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Merrill was always there. The Merrill issue was always there because Merrill was so powerful and was a shareholder of Bloomberg and was, for a very long time, the biggest single customer. So we were reporting on Merrill as we would report on any firm, and there were stories that people at Merrill didn't like. And I give Mike a lot of credit, because I'm sure half the time I didn't even hear about it. It just went straight to him, and I don't think he even brought it up. I obviously would hear about lots of other things, but so he was tested almost immediately by what we were reporting. Arguably, the one incident that kind of defined the whole issue and was a real test was, you may recall, in the late 90s, we were in the midst of a dot-com, what became known as the dot-com boom. And all kinds of companies were going public. In fact, hundreds of them were going public. This was when, of all things, something was invented called cash earnings, you know, at one point. You know,
Pet.com.
Right. So one of the most successful architects of this boom was at Credit Suisse.
Frank Quattroni. Yeah.
And Credit Suisse was a very aggressive firm at the time. The CEO of Credit Suisse had come from Bankers Trust, which was already an aggressive firm as well, bank, Alan Wheat. And Credit Suisse was blazing a trail everywhere in the world, and was getting into trouble with regulators everywhere, not just in the United States, but in Japan and in Europe. And Frank Quattrone was incurring greater and greater adversity in everything that he was doing. So he was obviously a story, and the firm was a story. And so we, at that point, had a magazine, monthly magazine, called Markets Magazine. And we had decided he was going to be the cover. And it was going to be a story of at least several thousand words. And we had made him aware of it and made the firm aware of it. And we were told, you know, if you write this story, because we were following the Bloomberg way, no secrets, we were saying, okay, this is what we have, this is what we're going to say. We were told, if you do that, you know, we're going to remove 70 Bloomberg terminals instantly from the firm. And that had been communicated to my colleagues, senior colleagues at Bloomberg, who were in other departments, and obviously had been communicated to Mike as well. And, you know, the only thing he wanted to know was, what do our lawyers say? I mean, what did we have? And of course, our lawyers were very involved. They were very busy. They had smiles on their faces, by the way.
Earning their fees.
And we did run this story. And we did lose 70 terminals, just like that. Now, a little more than 6 months later, Alan Wheat was out of Credit Suisse. New CEO came in. We got the terminals back. So, you know, it kind of has a happy ending. But that was, if you like, a crisis and a real test. And there were other incidents that came before that. For example, when our reporter, of all things, who's covering Deutsche Bank, and was in New York, and somehow was lucky enough to be invited to listen to a conversation that the head of the Deutsche Bank New York office, actually was head of all of North America, was saying to all of his colleagues, not just in New York, but over a phone line. And when he was done, and it was outlining sort of their strategy. So this was proprietary information, to say the least, that he didn't want to share with the public. But we had obtained this information for us in an honest way, even though the firm, you know, would look askance at somebody figuring out a way to let us in. So this also came to Mike's attention, and I said, well, this is how we did it, and we didn't trespass. You know, we were sort of given the keys to the kingdom, and that's what happens in journalism, and we got lucky, and, you know, better lucky than smart, is all I can say. So there was another example of, and they were a big customer and so on. So we had these, you know, incidents all through the 90s, fortunately, he was, you know, a mensch all the way through it, and it stood us in good stead, and it didn't impede our success in any way, and the company continued to add more customers. Because, as you know, if you treat everybody fairly and dispassionately, but always with the goal of what's the truth, or something closer to it. Yeah. Actually, that's a good business model in journalism. So he was benefiting from it.
I think for those reporters out there of my vintage, when Bloomberg really came sort of an omnipresent force was when you did something very interesting. And that was you started to give newspapers around North America, perhaps in other parts of the world as well, the Bloomberg terminal. And at the time, I was in New York for the Globe and Mail, and Norm Perlstein had given me an office in Barron's. And my editor phoned me up and said, you're going to be getting a Bloomberg terminal. And I said, that's great. What's a Bloomberg terminal? It was like 1991, 92. And then a few weeks later, I get a call, and it's security on the first floor of World Financial Center, Dow Jones Security. Are you McNish? Yes. There's a Bloomberg terminal here for you. Do you have security clearance? And I said, no. You're going to have to come down and pick it up yourself, because we're not taking it up to you. That was very odd, so I took it up and I installed it, And then 2 weeks later, I was in the cafeteria with my tuna fish sandwich, heading towards the table with some Wall Street Journal reporters. And do you remember Robert Prinsky?
Of course.
Yes, a wild-haired guy, looked like Einstein.
I worked for him.
It's just a very opinionated individual, very strong personality. And suddenly he was pointing to me like a Death Eater and going, there's the person with the Bloomberg terminal. And the whole room just looked at me in horror. So I took my sandwich and I went up to my little cubicle. And for the next 6 months, Wall Street Journal reporters and Dow Jones Wire reporters would show up. They'd look both ways to make sure no one was looking. And they all made a beeline for that terminal because they were very interested in it and very worried about it.
Well, you know, this comes out of the every problem is an opportunity category. It was not in any way an agenda item for us or a goal to give Bloomberg terminals to newspapers. The way that happened actually was somewhere in the transition between 1990 and 91, literally our first year. I was thinking, by the way, now about Washington. And I was especially thinking about data in Washington, like gross domestic product and durable goods and industrial production and consumer price index, all of which come from the government, but they come through what is known as a lockup. And the journalists administer, because the government doesn't want to be in the role of a censor in any way. So there is a committee of correspondents that decides who's going to go to these lockups. And I had thought, as it turns out rather cavalierly, that this was not going to be an issue or a problem. So I approached the then head of the committee, who happened to be a colleague, a Wall Street Journal colleague, Jeff Birnbaum, who was in Washington at the time. And I said, you know, we just started this news organization, Bloomberg, and we need to get the credentials to cover this data. So what do I have to do? And Jeff said, well, what are you? And I said, maybe a little pompously, we're an electronic newspaper. Well, what is that? And I said, oh, we're 24/7. All our news is on a computer terminal. And we have customers all over the world. And we're adding more reporters. And we need to cover all this data because our customers need to get it and understand what to do with it. And he said, OK. And he came back to me after a few days. And he said, we don't have a criteria for you. And I said, what do you mean? I thought that was outrageous. He said, well, you know, you have to be published somewhere. I said, we are. We're published on the Bloomberg terminal. He said, no. You have to be, you know, published. So I realized we were in trouble. This was not going to end well if we stayed on that path. Fortunately, I say every problem is an opportunity. My other friends, also from Dow Jones, Floyd Norris and Diana Henriquez, had migrated from Barron's to the New York Times. And when I got to Bloomberg, they were saying to me all the time, when I'd run into them, say, we don't have enough money for erasers at the Times. Can we get our hands on a Bloomberg terminal? And I would say to them, come on, Bundesbank pays, you know, you should pay. And brush them off. But now, dealing with the Committee of Correspondents in Washington, light bulb went on, and I said, oh, published. We're not published. We should be published. So I went to Diana and Floyd, and I said, look, I've got this problem. Here's what it is. And if we deliver to you news that, as you say, fit to print, because it's on your name, it's on your front page. In fact, it's a box right at the top, fit to print, all the news that's fit to print. If we deliver news that's fit to print, and you make that decision, but you publish it, I think I could give you a terminal. Would that be acceptable? And they took my modest proposal to Max Frankel, who was then the editor of the New York Times. And he thought that was fine. So within weeks, our first newspaper customer was the New York Times. And as I said, that was not something I had planned. But because, and it worked out, by the way, because we, as it happened, it forced us to think about the Times in a way we weren't thinking about the Times. And what's the Bloomberg way? And does the Bloomberg way work for the New York Times? It should work for, if we figured this out, right? Well, in any case, as soon as the New York Times had us and was publishing us, 40 other newspapers almost immediately said, well, we want the same thing. And I couldn't in good conscience say, no, the New York Times is better than you, or we favor the New York Times or whatever. So I went to Mike and I said, we have another problem here, which is all these newspapers want it. And he said, fine, it'll be good for us. And he was delighted. And so within a few years, we had hundreds of newspapers, not just in North America, but around the world, who had Bloomberg News. And the good thing about it was the best way to advertise, if you like, who we were to other journalists. Because, you know, if we were on the Bloomberg system, it was a little bit harder for other journalists to figure out what we were doing, because they couldn't see us so easily. And as I said, you know, this is still before Netscape changes everything. So we had a franchise, if you will, with newspapers in our infancy, and it would grow and become a huge syndicate. And as it turned out, by the end of the decade, most of them would become customers paying us for the service. So it turned out to be a great business model. But again, it comes under the heading of every problem is an opportunity.
So I'd like to move the conversation just a little bit more to sort of the current environment and the future. I mean, what a ride for 26 years. And now we're in a world where the newspapers and conventional media companies and Bloomberg are kind of converging in the sense that they've got their own websites, their own ability to flash news. A scoop that you once enjoyed for a year, or excuse me, a day, 24 hours or 2 days,
is now
got a shelf life of a minute before everyone's piling on.
Right.
So your currency isn't as valuable as it once was, neither is it for anyone else. What do you see, where does Bloomberg need to go in this environment of intense competition? I mean, our paper shifted away from the newspaper totally towards digital, mobile. How can you prevail? How do you get your edge in this kind of environment?
Well, I haven't changed my mind about this, even with all the changes, some of which have been very formidable and, as you say, disruptive and intimidating for us, like everybody else. But I haven't changed my mind about this. I still come back to how good is your data and what do you do with the data? And we have so many opportunities to take data as a tool for delivering the best news, or when I say the best news, news you can use. Let me give you an example of that. You know, last year, through the first 6 months of the year, the biggest global story, surprise, surprise, was Wither Greece. Okay? And the year started with Greece, new government, repudiating the old government, and insisting that it wasn't going to continue to accept the austerity burden that the EU had imposed on Greece. And so as the year progressed, as January went to February to March, this became a global story. And if you go back and you look at what everybody was saying on broadcast news, TV, radio, the net, their newspapers, the story was Greece is going to default and Greece is going to leave the euro, is going to leave the EU. And you could be forgiven for thinking, gosh, that was what everybody believed, because that's what everybody wrote, everybody said it. Well, if you had a Bloomberg, you could see something very early on that was counter to that prevailing view that could inform your reporting in such a way as you could say, not so fast. And here's what you could see. You could see that the yield on the benchmark Greek bond, even though it was not widely traded, it was traded every day, it existed. And the yield in 2015 never got anywhere near its worst level of 2012, when there really was a euro crisis. And if that was true, you'd say, I mean, it was true, you could say, well, wait a second, the people with the most at stake are not literally betting on Greek leaving the euro or defaulting, because if they were, that yield would be much higher. In other words, the bonds would be trading at 30 cents on the dollar, not 70 cents on the dollar. And so that's an example. And so we were able to write that. And of course, Greece did not default. It didn't leave the euro. The story went away after being everybody's front page news. But it was wrong. By the way, the best investment, any asset class, in 2015 were Greek bonds. Because if you bought them in June, sort of at the height of the
anxiety, I missed it.
You made 150%. So what I'm saying is there are lots of opportunities like that with data. You know, we're in an age of Twitter where you can say anything and people do, and it's there forever, and much of it is not true, and it's insidious. But we're also able to take advantage of data that we never could get access to when you and I were starting our careers as journalists, and we can do things with that data. To tell a story that's definitely relevant to everybody. And so I think that that's really the opportunity. And it's not just for us at Bloomberg. I mean, everybody can do this. I think we have some advantages because we've been collecting data for a very long time now. And that's what we do. But I do think, you know, for example, with this presidential election, there have been numerous occasions where the press, dare I say it, allowed misinformation to dominate or prevail because it didn't do the due diligence it could have done by just getting behind. I mean, for example, this whole issue of Donald Trump talking about NAFTA.
Right.
This is one of my, you know, real grievances, is that, you know, NAFTA was never, you know, the job creator or the job killer that either enthusiasts or detractors said. However, NAFTA made Canada, the US, and Mexico so much more efficient that their economies are so much better off and their people are so much better off. And you can just see lots of data that proves that, shows that. And that's a really powerful story, and it doesn't get reported on the nightly news or the morning news the way it should be.
Well, Trump made it easy for people to get a lot of clicks, a lot of stories, without having to do much
because
research.
He's an entertainer.
Right.
And so answering your question, I'm a news guy. I'm a newsman, not an entertainer. Right. But I think news is as exciting as it ever was, if not more so. And so I can't wait to find the surprise, as long as it's true, because if it's not true, it's not news. Donald Trump is in the entertainment business. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. And so I think we, as a profession, you know, have a problem because too many of us in the news business are either forced or co-opted to be in the entertainment business, and that's a mistake.
We're going to move to questions in a few minutes. One of the things I'd like to ask you is what advice you would give to young journalists today. The conventional mainstream newspapers and media companies are under stress. Display advertising, it's no secret, it's gone off a cliff. But there are other models out there. We've got the Washington Post, owned by Amazon, with what, 80 million Prime subscribers? Sort of a whole new different kind of model. We've got the New York Times buying Wirecutter. Is it going to be moving into the specialty product research area? And so it's sometimes hard to stick your finger up and figure out which way the wind is blowing.
Okay, well, you see two good examples right there. Two very established, traditionally highly respected, regarded properties in news, the Washington Post and the New York Times. And they have both, in their own way, embraced what I'm talking about. They've increasingly seized upon the need for data to drive the news that's fit to print, both the Washington Post and the New York Times. And for example, the New York Times, to cover the 2012 election, had Nate Silver, who is now on his own at ESPN doing 538, but 538 was a creation, a digital creation, actually, at the New York Times. And I know I'm not alone. I found Nate Silver in 2012, 538, far more useful than most of the narratives, which were essentially horse race political reporting. I found his, you know, insights from the polls far more revealing and meaningful. And so he leaves, and the New York Times creates something that's almost as good, if not better, maybe, called The Upshot. And so I do think that journalism is actually, since you asked the question, you know, what would I tell, I teach this course this semester at Northwestern in journalism, and I am telling the kids in that class, this is one of the most exciting times to be a journalist, because if you do this right, you're helping people make the most best informed decisions, which is really what you're there for. And you can become indispensable as a result.
I think I lied. I've got one more question, and that is, I think if you're a business journalist today, you often feel you're under siege. There are more public companies that are going private, so we don't have the same access to information. There seem to be a lot more lawyers, corporate lawyers, trying to stop you from doing what you're doing. My colleague John Carreyrou, what he went through at Theranos, and I'm sure there are examples. At Bloomberg as well, it is relentless. Do you despair of that? What are your thoughts about it? Do these things just go in waves?
You know, I don't think there was ever really a golden period. We like to think so. I think every period that, at least in US and Canadian journalism, has had its challenges, to say the least. And this time is no different. But there are inherent strengths that we can marshal to our advantage against weaknesses that are obvious and prevailing, as you just said. But I think as long as we're committed, it's really committed to integrity, it's a wonderful occupation. To me, it doesn't get any better.
All right, so if there are any questions, we have a microphone, and I would ask that you identify yourself and speak loudly and clearly. This is being filmed for C-SPAN, and Matt is yours. Ask away. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike Omelis with Global News. I think it was a few years ago, 2013, when Bloomberg journalists were reported to have gone through the back door terminal access to access proprietary client information, chat rooms and things like that, to use in their journalism. How much of a reputational hit was that for Bloomberg, and has the service fully recovered?
That was really about something that Mike Bloomberg actually himself invented. And what it was a way to organize everybody's use of the terminal. The Bloomberg terminal was called UUID. And what that meant was that everybody inside Bloomberg, including news, by the way, could see what keys, subject keys, equity, debt, our customers were using. We never ever got to the point where we knew what they were doing or how they were doing it. All we could do was, in fact, what prompted the inquiry, and it was later an inquisition, was we could see who was at work today, because we could see a little dot that said this person is using a Bloomberg. That became the issue that somehow we were, some of the reports said snooping. As it turned out, we did our own, just to satisfy our customers, our own investigation, and there was no, was pretty thorough. There was no incident anywhere in the world where a reporter was doing something that he or she shouldn't have done, other than use the terminal as it was meant to be used. And when he came back to the company, Mike Bloomberg said, I don't know what all the fuss was about. So it clearly didn't impair our relationship with, or hurt our reputation. I mean, partly because no one ever saw a story that was written anywhere that was derived from anything nefarious.
Teresa. Hi there. Hi, Matt. Teresa Evans, your former bond market reporter in Canada. I can't let you not have a question about the U.S. election. So I'm going to ask, do you feel that the U.S. media did enough to vet Donald Trump as a candidate, generally, your own organization that you hail from, as well as media in general?
We were talking earlier about just that, and I was saying that in January, one of our television anchors had done an interview with Donald Trump, and this is maybe even before the New Hampshire primary, but it was somewhere around there, and he was giving a lot of interviews. We had one, and I was asked after some of the interview was aired. I was on the TV set, and I was asked, so Matt, what's missing from this interview we just did? And I said, the facts. That's all I said. And then we went to another story. But look, all kidding aside, I think that he is an entertainer, first and foremost. I could say worse things, and my boss did at the Democratic convention. And as I said earlier with Jackie, there's a real risk that the news business loses sight of what it's meant to do and is in the entertainment business. It wouldn't be the first time. I'm not saying something that's particularly original. I do think that there's no question that Trump was good for ratings. We all know that. Because he was good for ratings, there was an incentive, a commercial incentive, a business incentive, and arguably even a journalistic incentive, because if you think about it, if more people are going to read my story because I have Trump in the headline and Trump in the narrative, well, it must be a good story, right? Because more people are going to read it. And I think that that's hazardous and perilous, and that's the wrong way to go about thinking. I do believe names make news. They always do, and every journalist should operate that way. It's in the Bloomberg way, names make news. But once you get beyond names make news, you have to ask yourself, okay, what is the news? And unfortunately, in this case with Trump, there's no question about it. Among other things, he's a serial liar. And serial liars shouldn't be allowed to become serial liars. So I do think that that is sadly one of the takeaways from this campaign. I mean, and only belatedly are we coming to terms with it. You know, the New York Times, sort of late, but not too late, I think, decided that it was going to confront directly the lies in its reporting, and that got a lot of attention when the New York Times decided to do that. Other news organizations have since done the same thing.
Sort of the antithesis of your accuracy focus.
Yeah, I mean, look, accuracy above all else is what we are meant to do and aspire to do. And sadly, in this election, we got confused and we lost it. There was a false equivalency that pervaded reporting. By the way, this happened sadly with Brexit as well. You know, the BBC has a requirement that says, you know, everybody gets equal time, you know, in a contest. Unfortunately, what the Liebers were saying was completely ludicrous, false, in the UK. And because of that false equivalency that was imposed for journalists, you could argue that the public was not well served. You know, we found out the next day when the leaders of the Leave campaign acknowledged that everything that they had said basically was not true.
So since no one else is here, can I ask a question about your business model? Because having been in your New York office, and it's beautiful, it's got energy, and it looks gorgeous. And
Toronto one isn't bad either, you know.
Not bad, but you don't have the spiral escalator and Ozzy Osbourne being interviewed. Okay.
Well,
and Gene Wilder.
Here's hoping, one of these days.
Yeah. I wanted to ask if you had any advice in general for other news organizations, because you've managed to tie it to a product that everybody wants, and now everybody else is trying to figure out how to cross-sell into something that everyone wants. What do you think the future of news organizations is, and what would your advice be to them?
You know, the truth is so hard to come by. It's such a rare, scarce thing, commodity. If news organizations could figure out a way to deliver more truth every day, I do think that's a winning proposition. I really do. And it doesn't matter where you're coming from or where you are. I do think it's important. You know, in the US, for example, I would say this to journalists in all kinds of cities and towns. I said, you know, state and local government arguably is the most important subject. What every community has to wrestle with is how much money they spend on their services and everything else and the tax rolls. And the sad truth is that, and I'm not picking on any one institution, but JP Morgan knows more about what's going on in your town than you do, and you live there. And my point is that in cities, villages, towns, states, a public understanding of what is happening every day with the tax receipts of that community is opaque. And it would be a huge service, public service, for journalists to follow that money. I'm talking about the US, but I think it's true everywhere too.
Thank you very much for the chat. My question has to do with a story or series of stories that you are most proud of. Some of the work that you've done has been recognized by the highest awards, but I'm curious if there's anything specific that you are most proud of individually. And as well, what do you think is an area that you'd like to see more coverage of in the future? Thank you.
So, as Jackie said, we were fortunate. I was fortunate, you know, just a year ago, we won the Pulitzer Prize for very extensive, exhaustive reporting on what we kind of discovered called tax inversions, which is where US companies figure out a way to take advantage of much more attractive tax regimes outside of the United States so that by corporate massaging, they can avoid paying U.S. taxes, and it became a big issue. But that happened, you know, relative in the past 4 or 5 years in our reporting. The actual story that were stories that I think defined us and set us apart, and we were alone, we did in the 90s, in the early 90s, which was a wonderful decade, by the way. It was, as Jackie said, it was a time of extraordinary growth in the US. There was a wonderful book written by the late, great Haynes Johnson, the Washington Post, called The Best of Times, and it was about the Clinton 90s, because even with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, in fact, you could argue things were so good, we could spend all our time on the Monica Lewinsky scandal, because the gap between rich and poor narrowed, the dot-com boom took off, More jobs were created in the 90s than any other time in American history, actually, 22 million jobs. Anyway, there was something really bad happening at that same time, and that was, and it was legal, by the way, companies routinely would invite their best shareholders, their analysts, into a room like this one. They'd close the door, and the CEO would, or someone like him or her, would say, you know what, next year's gonna be really terrific. And people would reach for their, they didn't have quite the mobile devices we have today, but they would reach for their phones, and they would call their friends who could do this for them, and they would buy and sell, usually buy, because it was a bull market. And that day, you would see these amazing moves in the stock price of very important companies, whether it was Fannie Mae, Morgan Stanley, you name it. And the companies would say, we know no reason why our shares went up today. You know, they would say that. You can go back and you can find these quotes over and over. So we knew, because we were following this, that this selective disclosure, as it's called, was ubiquitous, was widespread. And we knew that, you know, what they were doing was treating some shareholders better than others. It was totally unfair. And so we created on the Bloomberg a category, just like, you know, news about Toronto or news about the Fed, called HUSH, H-U-S-S-H. And that was where all the stories about companies doing selective disclosure went. And of course, it infuriated many of those companies. Our lawyers actually got note of this. They had smiles on their face because people threatened to sue us over reporting what was going on. And we did this over and over again, you know, literally year after year. We started somewhere around 1993, 94, and we just kept going. And as we got to later in the decade, it just became more rampant. And we did this very long story about Western Digital, still around, California company. And their stock price, because they had this conference in the Phoenicia Hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona, you know, and we had sent a reporter there. The hotel knew we were sending a reporter there and said, you can't register here, whatever. So it was Dave Evans, they kicked him out. But he figured out a way to somehow get in anyway. And so he learned, literally, the CEO is speaking to a group of people, and Western Digital share price that day was the greatest in its history. It was extraordinary. And they, of course, said, we know no reason why our shares went up. Well, we had other examples in the story besides that one. And the SEC finally paid attention to it. And at the end of the decade, the Securities and Exchange Commission, in a 3-2 vote, passed what became known as Regulation FD for Fair Disclosure, Reg FD. All of our competitors, by the way, because we were the new guy and we were an outsider, were against this rule because they thought that, you know, selective disclosure meant they were on the inside getting scoops. So we were the only news organization that took the position that Reg FD should be. And of course it was passed and it exists to this day. So I sort of feel like that was a good way to begin for a news organization. We did lots of other things besides that, but that's the one where I think we set ourselves apart.
Another question?
Hi there. Thank you so much for your talk. My name is Rebecca Fortin. I am, I'm just going to do this, I'm short. I am a fellow here at University of Toronto in global journalism, just starting into the field. I've been working as a public health professional for the past 10 years, and data is really important in our field. In fact, the health unit I come from, we can't even really order a pizza without looking at a systematic review. So I'm just curious, as somebody getting into a field that moves a lot faster than government, what your litmus test is for good data versus bad data?
Well, the best data is the data that can be shared that's transparent, that can be easily replicated. And if that is true, then it will be used, consumed, and that's healthy and good. You know, an example of that is the best developed economies have the confidence of investors because, if you like, the data that comes out of Canada and comes out of the US and comes out of the EU is data that can be trusted and easily replicated and verified, empirically verified. So that's how important data is. Where you get to places where the data is not so easily transparent or replicated, there's less confidence and therefore less investment and therefore less growth. And the opposite is true. You know, those are very troubled places. So that's how important data is. And we should, as journalists, insist that there be more of it for as many people as possible.
Hi, James.
Hi, I'm James Raja from the Globe and Mail. I think it was after Mike Bloomberg came back to the company after his mayoralty, it was reported that he apparently asked the question internally, why exactly does Bloomberg even need a website? And I'm wondering how that question got answered at Bloomberg in terms of the balance between the information that a lot of people pay not inconsiderable sums of money to get through the terminal versus the news and information that's available for free through the website.
Yeah, that's an existential question at Bloomberg. And it's been at Bloomberg almost, you know, since the beginning of the World Wide Web, as we called it in its beginning. And you're quite right. You could argue that the Bloomberg business model, which is the terminal itself, is maybe one of the greatest internet business models around. The reason why I've always argued, and I have some colleagues who agree with me, the reason why the argument persists to this day is because while we are championing this system called the Bloomberg, which is enormously complicated and diverse in scope of what it does, we want to, as journalists, reach as many people as we possibly can. And it's kind of like, you know, the newspaper franchise that we had that I said was kind of a surprise, wasn't intended. You know, you could argue that the internet and Bloomberg.com are an extension of that newspaper franchise that we had, which is to say, we want as many people to be aware of the best of Bloomberg as possible, and we can't possibly unbundle what's in the Bloomberg terminal onto a Bloomberg website. It's just not feasible, and we wouldn't do it, and we never have done it. But what we do every day is we essentially take what we think are highlights from the Bloomberg, and by no means anything close to the data that's in it, and we make it available to everybody on the web. I've always felt that that's benign. I don't think it cannibalizes the product. Were he here, Mike would probably think that's a ridiculous assumption that I make. But it's a debate, and I happen to think it's a healthy debate, even if it's painful for us to live through repeatedly. But that's where we are, and you know, that's probably where we'll be.
Got one more question over here.
Sue Simon, I'm just basically a consumer of media. I have a question about polling. Can you speak to the reliability of that data set? What I've experienced in the last number of elections, from my perspective, I'm not sure which the cart's coming before the horse. And I think you refer to that as a a data set that's being used more and more often.
Sure. So I am not, by the way, qualified to give any kind of judgment about either polls in general or specific polls, because I'm really nothing more than a consumer of them. And I only know what I read, and my reading is not anywhere near as advanced as it would need to be to give you that kind of answer that you're looking for. But what I can say this about, the reason why you know, there is a opportunity with polls. The best information are the people who look at as many polls as possible, and they, using algorithms, they calculate probability from those statistics. And that's where I'm very much a fan, because I believe that for journalists, probability and statistics actually is a very important pillar of knowledge in covering events. The more awareness of probability and statistics, the more informed your readers are going to be. And so I liken the best, if you will, sites that take with the most advanced scientific or mathematical models all of the polling data, and they synthesize it. And I'll give you some examples. I mentioned Nate Silver's 538, but there's a wonderful and very advanced site called the Princeton Election Consortium, run by Sam Wang, who's a neuroscientist, by the way, by occupation. That's really what he does. But his hobby is following electoral politics, and he does it by literally grabbing all the data that exists from everybody's polls and pulling them together. A more popular site is Huff Pollster. Huffington Post does something similar, but nowhere near as advanced as what Sam Wang does. There's a wonderful site called PredictWise that is run by a Microsoft engineer, David Rothschild. His real job is working for Microsoft. He's also a professor, I think, at Columbia University. But he runs this site called PredictWise, and he takes polls, betting, literally every scrap of data he can get his hands on that is somehow representing somebody with a stake, and he pulls it together. And so what you get is, I think, for the time that it's shared, a very informed perspective about what's going on. And to me, it's in some ways much more valuable than somebody just doing anecdotal reporting here and there, because it's much more comprehensive. So that's what I was talking about. And it doesn't mean that they're infallible. I'm just saying that they are hugely useful to providing perspective. You know, when you're reading a story that says this candidate is in trouble, or, you know, is bound to win, and then you see all the data next to it, you could draw a completely different conclusion and probably a much more informed one.
All right, I'm going to ask the last question, and that's, speaking of polling, do you think Hillary will sweep in Congress? And if she wins, what can we, as her largest trading partner, expect from her government, in your
okay.
opinion?
So this is the answer I hope you would expect me to say. I'm just a reporter.
oh, come on.
And
who are they going to tell?
Here's what I know from my reporting, our reporting. If one looks at all the polls that are available to us, it shows that at this point, her lead in the polls is a little bit better than where Obama was in 2012, and maybe at least as good as where he was in 2008, which means that's an electoral college landslide.
Wow.
Okay, that's what that means. Now, what is unknown is, in this election, unlike in the most recent ones, going back three or four presidencies, there are states in play that were not in play for quite some time, like Arizona. Like Utah, of all states. I mean, it's voted Republican as far back as I've been alive, I think. And with a couple exceptions, really. So these are sort of unknowns. We don't know, you know, we don't know whether what the pollsters call a wave election or not. We don't know if this is a wave election or not. The data says that if her margin in the polls creeps up to something more than 12 percentage points. And there was a poll that came out earlier in the week that said she was 12 points ahead. But if it really is something like that, and it gets a little bit beyond that, that could be a wave. But we don't know. Right now, we don't know. We just know that she's ahead, and the probability of her winning is, you know, from Nate Silver's 84.5% to New York Times says 93% right now on their website. So it's somewhere between there.
All right, Matt Winkler.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Natalie Turvey. I am Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. On behalf of the CJF, Matt, it's been an honor to have you with us, and thank you for sharing your candid insights on the evolution of business news, your passion for great journalism, and your personal stories on what it takes to build a powerhouse institution in one of the world's largest newsrooms. And thank you also to the always excellent Jackie McNish for leading tonight's discussion and for the work you put into making this a compelling and thoughtful talk. Please join me in a round of appreciation for both of our speakers. Before we head into the cocktail reception, I have a brief CJF commercial to preview some of our upcoming events. We hope you'll join us. So coming up on November 3rd, we're tackling a timely and important issue in partnership with JHR, Journalists for Human Rights. We're joined by leading Indigenous journalists for a conversation on the state of media on Aboriginal affairs. On November 15th, we explore the intersection of journalism and technology with some of the main players who first reshaped the media landscape and who've made it clear they're here to stay. Twitter, BuzzFeed, and Vice are in conversation with the Globe and Mail's Simon Haupt. And on November 30th, John Rick MacArthur, publisher of the 166-year-old Harper's Magazine, is with us. He's a strong proponent of print, and he joins us for a conversation on magazine journalism in a digital age. We hope to see you at these events, and our thanks to you for joining us and for supporting CJF JTalks. It is now my pleasure to invite you to stay with us, meet our speakers, and continue the conversation at the cocktail reception.